role in communist Czechoslovakia. As the months went on, Dubček implemented a series of reforms in an attempt to bring about socialism with a human face. His guiding principle was the idea of making socialism function as it had been promised, trying to build a thriving nation that abandoned as many elements of authoritarianism as possible. For months, Dubček rolled out reforms, including attempts to allow greater freedom of expression while decreasing the government's reliance on the secret police in order to maintain political control. Freeing political prisoners became a topic of discussion, and the Slovakian half of the country was given more autonomy. At a certain point, even looked as if Dubček would be introducing some democratic measures, creating the possibility that the Communist Party would lose its monopoly on power. This period of hopeful reform became known as the Prague Spring, a renaissance of civil society blooming throughout every aspect of the Central European country. As spring turned to summer, word came down from Moscow that Dubček was moving too quickly. The final straw came when Dubček started to distance himself from the Warsaw Pact, which was much too reminiscent of Imrie-Nyagy's actions a decade prior. On July 16, 1968, Dubček was given a written warning by the other members of the pact that he was playing a dangerous game, pointing out that the peoples of our countries won a victory over Hitlerite fascism at the price of immense sacrifices. What became known as the Warsaw Letter went on to state that the strength and solidarity of our ties depend on the internal strength of the socialist system of each of our fraternal countries, as well as the Marxist-Leninist policy of our parties, which are playing a leading role in the political and social life of their peoples and states. Policies that undermine the leading role of the Communist Party will lead to the destruction of socialist democracy and of the socialist system. Thus, the foundations of our ties and the security of the community of our countries will be placed in danger. Here was born the Brezhnev Doctrine, named after the Soviet leader who had succeeded Nikita Khrushchev in 1964. Brezhnev's policy was that the socialist nations, and the USSR especially, had an obligation to defend the gains that socialism had made. If a given nation were to turn against socialism in a counter-revolutionary manner, the other socialist nations had a duty to intervene in order to prevent that, by force, if necessary. It was not only Russian citizens who could not escape the USSR, neither could those countries aligned with the Soviet Union. 1 month after the Warsaw Letter, forces from Bulgaria, Poland, Hungary, and the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia with East German support. Prague citizens witnessed firsthand whether it was true that the city's cobblestone streets were easier ones for Russian tanks to navigate. Dubček was arrested but was spared Nagy's fate, getting expelled from the party and shuffled off to an obscure forestry job in Slovakia. His successor, Gustav Husák, slowly but surely undid virtually everything that Dubček had accomplished. President Lyndon Johnson, the Secretary of State, and the American ambassador to the UN all refused to do or say anything. So where would someone trapped behind the Iron Curtain look for hope? What possible reason would they have to think the totalitarians ever give up on their absolutist ideology? Why would their rulers ever voluntarily renounce their power? And what could possibly stop them militarily? The Korean War had been a draw. The Vietnam War was a disaster for the West. The Soviet Union clearly wasn't going anywhere. Marginally intelligent people love importing words from other languages because they signal multilingualism and internationalism, both supposed indicators of brain power and sophistication. The key word of this era was détente. The approximate English translation of relaxation sounds a lot less impressive because the subtext was stalemate. Begun under Richard Nixon and heavily associated with his advisor Henry Kissinger, détente codified into a semi-official policy of being realistic and acknowledging that the world would be divided into a communist East and a liberal democratic West for decades. To come. People needed to accept things as they were, not simply how they wished or imagined them to be. Pretending otherwise was both utopian and naive and dangerous to boot. We would just have to figure out a way to live with one another. As such, it was important for both superpowers to acknowledge the state of affairs and to figure out ways of lessening tensions and increasing communications with one another whenever possible. Dovetailing with the idea of détente was the concept of MAD, mutual assured destruction. Both the United States and the Soviet Union had enough nuclear weapons at this point to blow up one another dozens of times over, almost certainly destroying life on Earth in the process. As such, it was crucial to take steps to avoid the Cold War exploding into open warfare, as had happened several times over the past decades. The bipartisan American foreign policy consensus was tethered to the view that, like it or not, the Soviet Union was here to stay. The experts agreed that only a lunatic playing a dangerous game with nuclear war would think any differently. As one infamous 1964 campaign ad stated, "We must either love each other or we must die." It took the pairing of a woman and a man to throw this consensus into the trash. Her view was that consensus seems to be the process of abandoning all beliefs, principles, values, and policies. So it is something in which no one believes and to which no one objects. As for him, "My idea of American policy toward the Soviet Union is simple, and some would say simplistic," he said in 1977. "It is this: we win and they lose." Chapter 11, Less Than Nothing. What has gone down in history as one of the all-time great political romances might be better viewed as a Hollywood buddy comedy. Though their worldviews were highly compatible and often identical, the relationship between President Ronald Reagan and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher epitomized the cliche that politics makes for strange bedfellows. He was a smooth operator, always with a joke on hand, relying on anecdotes instead of data to put across his point of view. She was strident and serious to the point of being a scold, someone who did not hesitate to lecture whomever happened to be in earshot. Neither took a traditional path towards heading the governments of their respective countries. The woman who became the second Mrs. Dennis Thatcher was born in 1925 above her father's grocery store in suburban Grantham, the incarnation of the petty bourgeoisie that Lenin so despised for their small-minded provincialism. Always a daddy's girl, Margaret Roberts' interest in politics was sparked at an early age by her father Alfred's local career. He served on the Grantham Town Council starting in 1927, before becoming alderman in 1943 and mayor in 1945. He was voted out when Labor took over the council, a quiet trauma that the young Margaret witnessed firsthand. When she was still in her 20s, a fortune teller supposedly told Margaret that she would be as great as Churchill. It is of some interest to consider how that story got out, for it would be a very clever way for Margaret to boast without having to make the claim herself. Growing up, it wasn't obvious that she was destined to any sort of greatness at all. She ended up getting a chemistry degree at Oxford, where her classmates universally agreed that she was fairly unexceptional and possessed little of the charisma or popularity that one would expect from a future politician. Admittedly well-spoken, young Margaret made three attempts for Parliament between 1950 and 1954 and lost all three. Her 1951 marriage to the wealthy Dennis Thatcher gave her the financial freedom to study law and pass the bar, as well as the resources to balance focusing on her political career while raising their pair of twins. In 1959, Thatcher was given the nomination for the safe conservative seat of Finchley and was elected to Parliament 5 days before her 34th birthday. Reagan's path was quite a different one. Born in 1911 under President William Howard Taft, the rural Illinois native grew up to become a successful lifeguard and a graduate of Eureka College, not quite as impressive as Thatcher's Oxford degree. The tall, handsome Reagan then went on to become a radio sportscaster. There, he developed the skill of talking for an extended period of time without actually saying anything, a very useful skill for a future politician to have. Between pitches and innings, there was usually a lot of dead time that I had to fill with anecdotes and descriptions of the players, the field, and the weather, he recalled. I wish I could count the number of ways I managed to describe how the rays of the afternoon sun looked as they fell across the rim of Wrigley Field. Reagan also figured out how to make things seem fine to the public when in fact things were anything but, simply by making things up. After the wire went dead during one of the games he was announcing, he tried to stall in order to keep fans from turning the knob to a competitor's station. I decided to let Jurgis foul off the pitch, figuring Western Union would soon fix the problem. To fill in some time, I described a couple of kids in the stands fighting over the foul ball. I had Jurgis foul off another ball, I slowed Dean down, had him pick up the resin bag and take a sign, shake it off, get another sign, and let him pitch. I said he'd fouled off another one, but this time he just missed a home run by only a few inches. Jurgis hit a foul ball, and then another, and another. A red-headed kid in the stands retrieved one of the fouls and held up the ball to show off his trophy. I continued to let Jurgis foul Dean's pitches, and his string of foul balls went on for almost 7 minutes. I don't know how many foul balls there were, but I'm told someone reported the foul slugging spree as a record to Ripley's Believe It or Not column. A fortuitous trip to Hollywood earned Reagan a contract as an actor, and by eventually getting elected as president of the Screen Actors Guild, Reagan was thereby the first union leader to become president of the United States. When he once gave a speech to a citizens group denouncing fascism, Reagan added a line condemning communism as well. The dead silence from the audience made him realize just how prevalent Stalinist infiltration of American culture had become. Reagan eventually testified in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee as a friendly witness 3 days after Ayn Rand had. The media claim was that investigating Communist Party activity was all a witch hunt. But as playwright Molly Day Thatcher put it, those witches did not exist. Communists do, here and everywhere in the world. It's a false parallel. Witch hunt? The phrase would indicate that there are no communists in the government, none in the big trade unions, none in the press, none in the arts, none sending money from Hollywood to 12th Street. No one who was in the party and left uses that phrase. They know better. Arthur Miller's 1953 play The Crucible was a transparent metaphor for the search for communists in Hollywood and Washington. Yet in later years, he did not mince words about how naive he and many of his fellow influencers had been. Given the depth of our alienation from the failing capitalism of the time, it would have been intolerable to see the clear parallels between the social institutions of the fascist and Nazi regimes and those of the Soviet Union. Captive trade unions, mass youth organizations, secret police, informers in the workplace and the home, masses of political prisoners, and at the center of it vitriol, idolatry of the state and its leader. All of these had originated in the Soviet system. Fascism and Nazism were imitations of Soviet forms, with manic nationalism and racism replacing international proletarian solidarity as their central spiritual content. The generic enmity between the two systems turned out to be no deeper than the enmity of England for France at certain times in history or of Germany for England. Reagan's relatively brief marriage and divorce to fellow actor Jane Wyman led to him going on a date with a young starlet named Nancy Davis. Davis had reached out to him as a SAG official because she shared the same name as an actress who had been identified as a communist. The two were inseparable ever since, an odd pairing that sometimes puzzled even their children. Whereas Reagan regarded every stranger as a friend he hadn't met, the ambitious Nancy developed a reputation for being cold and more than a bit of a social climber. By the 1960s, Reagan's acting career began to dry up. He started to spend time crisscrossing America under the auspices of General Electric, speaking about issues from a conservative perspective. Then and always a huge FDR fan, Reagan remained a Democrat despite his political views. Although I was still saying the same things that I'd said for 6 years during the Eisenhower administration, he remembered, I was suddenly being called a right-wing extremist. It was when he was campaigning for Richard Nixon during the former vice president's 1962 run for California governor that a registrar in the audience stood up and challenged Reagan as to his party of choice. He changed his party affiliation to Republican on the spot before continuing on with his speech. By then, Nixon was already regarded with particular animosity by Democrats and more than a few Republicans. In 1946, Republicans had recaptured the House of Representatives and the Senate for the first time since FDR's New Deal. A whopping 55 new Republican congressmen won seats that year, including the new representative from California's 12th district, Richard Nixon. At the time, many in the media viewed the claims of longtime Democratic State Department apparatchik Alger Hiss being a Soviet spy were basically a widely discredited conspiracy theory, a right-wing fantasy designed to smear one of our nation's most patriotic public servants. Was there no depth to which the Republicans wouldn't sink? Have you no decency, sir? There was one little problem. Hiss was a spy, and Nixon was key to demonstrating his guilt of working for Stalin. Central to this was testimony from Whitaker Chambers, who had been a fellow traveler with Hiss in Communist Party circles. Hiss was eventually convicted of perjury and spent several years in jail. But the press never forgave Nixon for exposing their malfeasance and never let him forget it. Springboarding off his anti-communist cred, in 1950, Nixon decided to go for a job promotion and run for the United States Senate. His opponent was Congresswoman Helen Gehagen Douglas, and Nixon successfully painted the Pink Lady, not fully a communist red, as being soft in the Soviet Union. Nixon won by almost 20 points, 59-40%, an utter massacre. This quickly led to him becoming Eisenhower's running mate in 1952. In 6 years, Richard Nixon went from being a layman to a representative, a senator, and then one heartbeat away from the presidency. There was no stopping this dick. In 1960, Nixon became the Republican candidate for president and wound up losing the closest election in United States history to John F. Kennedy. There was, in fact, some stopping of this dick. No matter, he thought, he would run for governor of California and use that to seek the White House again, either in 1964 or 1968. After all, he was still only 47 years old. The sitting Democratic governor of California had other ideas. Pat Brown had been elected in 1958 by a margin similar to Nixon's in 1950, 60-40% over sitting Senator William Noland. Nixon would have his work cut out for him to make up that margin. The 1962 campaign for California governor, as with all of Nixon's campaigns, was bitter and divisive. When the results came in, Brown was reelected by a 5-point margin, 52%-47%. Pat Brown had slain the biggest dragon in the Republican Party, the former vice president who had almost been elected president just 2 years prior. Nixon, humiliated and disgraced, gave his notorious press conference where he lambasted the media. But as I leave you, he told the reporters, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. On the national stage, things were about to get even worse for the Republicans. Prompted by activists such as Phyllis Schlafly and her self-published A Choice, Not an Echo, the argument was made that the Republicans had been having their asses handed to them since Hoover because they had simply nominated Me Too candidates for the White House. No one genuinely prefers the store brand, the generic substitute, but they might prefer a different brand altogether. If the American people had the option of a strong conservative nominee that could provide a contrast to the left, then that candidate would win. The 1964 nomination of Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater was easily the Republicans' most conservative pick since the days of Calvin Coolidge, and the party establishment did pretty much everything in their power to stop Goldwater. It was very clear that Goldwater had virtually no chance, especially since President Kennedy's assassination the year before, and incumbent Democrat President Lyndon Johnson barely even bothered to campaign. One of the few celebrities to hitch their wagons to the Goldwater campaign was Ronald Reagan. A week before the election, he delivered a nationally televised speech making the case for Goldwater's version of conservatism and his personal vision of what America meant, referencing Cuba's relatively recent communist takeover. Not too long ago, two friends of mine were talking to a Cuban refugee, a businessman who had escaped from Castro. And in the midst of his story, one of my friends turned to the other and said, "We don't know how lucky we are." And the Cuban stopped and said, "How lucky you are. I had someplace to escape to." And in that sentence, he told us the entire story. If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth. Despite Reagan's best efforts, LBJ won re-election with 61%, the highest percentage of the popular vote since James Monroe had been re-elected without opposition in 1820. Further, and despite having 26 up for election to the Republicans' 9, the Democrats still managed to pick up two more Senate seats for a 68-32 majority. The House results were even worse for the GOP, as Democrats picked up 37 seats to cement a 295-140 seat lead that they had not seen since FDR's heyday. The Republican Party was effectively powerless in Washington, and Goldwaterism was dead and buried. The corporate press, the Democrats, the establishment Republicans, all were ready to proclaim Goldwaterism to be a juvenile, brain-dead philosophy from a bygone era that had now been put before the public and thoroughly repudiated. It's 1964. How are we still having this conversation? Yet Reagan's speech was very well received and did more for his political career than it did for Goldwater's. Though she had advised the Goldwater campaign, Ayn Rand grew dissatisfied with what she perceived to be the candidate's increasing anti-intellectualism. She was not alone in looking at the outcome of the election and proclaiming that it is too late for the conservatives. There's nothing left to conserve. Nor was she alone in singling out Reagan as the Republican winner of 1964, arguing that the best of the Goldwater campaign was a speech by Ronald Reagan. All of the candidate's speeches should have been on a level equal to Mr. Reagan's. With the wind behind him and at the strong urging of Nancy, Reagan set his sights on the California governor's mansion. In 1965, he released his first autobiography with the wacky title Where's the Rest of Me, being a reference to a movie scene where his character wakes up in a panic to discover that his legs had been amputated. The reaction to Reagan's announcement was as expected. The idea of a Governor Ronald Reagan could have been considered a joke if it were actually funny. The washed-up has-been actor should have been slipping on a banana peel in some vaudeville routine. But the governor's mansion? Oh, please. Didn't he have another movie to make about being friends with a chimpanzee? Pat Brown thought he had in the bag when he was running for re-election, especially since LBJ had carried California 59-41%. When Goldwater advocates claimed that in your heart you know he's right, the reply was in your guts you know he's nuts. And now, one of these Goldwater nuts was going to run for governor against the man who had just driven near President Richard Nixon out of politics forever? The election ended up being a bloodbath. After Governor Brown fended off a primary challenge from Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty, he never quite gained the momentum that he needed. Whereas Reagan promised to clean up the mess at Berkeley, an early bit of the future warfare between conservatives and hard-left universities, Brown ran a widely condemned ad comparing him to Lincoln assassin John Wilkes Booth, using the dubious reasoning that both men had been actors. When Reagan was criticized for having no experience, he had a quick retort. "The man who has the job has more experience than anybody. That's why I'm running." Though a Reagan election victory seemed probable, his margin of victory was a surprise. He trounced the incumbent governor 58-42%, winning 55 out of California's 58 counties, including Los Angeles, and by double digits. Reagan's ascension to the governor's mansion was paralleled by Thatcher climbing the ladder in parliament. Under the British system, the opposition party has a shadow cabinet consisting of MPs who serve as parallels to the current members of Her Majesty's government. When Labour is in power, for example, the Conservatives have a shadow health secretary and so forth. In 1967, loyal Tory Margaret Thatcher was recommended to leader of the opposition Ted Heath for just such an assignment, as Heath was looking for women to appoint but had few female Conservatives to choose from. "Yes, Willie agrees that she's much the most able," Heath said, referring to the Tory whip. "But," he says, "once she's there, we'll never be able to get rid of her." Thatcher thus became Shadow Secretary of State for Education and Science in 1967. "I did not make a particularly important contribution to Shadow Cabinet," she later admitted, "nor was I asked to do so. I was principally there as the statutory woman whose main task was to explain what women, our uniform undifferentiated sex, were likely to think and want on troublesome issues." After the Conservatives took control of Parliament in 1970, Education Secretary Margaret Thatcher proposed cutting a World War II era program to subsidize free milk for school children by limiting it to those under 7 years of age. The press savaged her as Margaret Thatcher Milk Snatcher, and she was driven to display the empty contents of her pantry. Thatcher managed to survive, but she gained a lifelong reputation for being cold and indifferent to the poor. The milk scandal nevertheless taught Thatcher a valuable